You're listening to The Pivot, brought to you by Globally News, where we discuss the leaders, states, networks, ideologies, and technologies that are reshaping the world order. Visit our website at globally.news. That's globe.news.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to The Pivot. My name is Arif Rafiq, and I'm your host. This year, more than half of the world's population will go to the polls, making 2024 the most important election year in world history. This year's first general elections have just taken place in Bangladesh. This South Asian state is the world's eighth most populous country and the fourth most populous in the Muslim world. And it's home to one of the world's fastest growing developing economies. But like Egypt's presidential elections last month, the results of these parliamentary polls, which took place on Sunday, were already a foregone conclusion. Prime Minister Sheikh Hasina Wajid, who's ruled Bangladesh since 2009, and her Awami League are returning to power. The main opposition party, the Bangladesh Nationalist Party, or BNP, boycotted the polls. Its leader, the former two-time Prime Minister Khaleda Zia, is currently hospitalized and has been under detention since 2018. Hasina's hope, it appears, is that her chief rival, Ms. Zia, and her party will soon die. Political and civil space is also dying under Hasina. Bangladesh has seen a surge in extrajudicial killings and a clampdown on civil society and the media. Last week's conviction of celebrated Grameen Bank founder Muhammad Yunus is a chilling reminder of the extent to which Hasina is willing to repress competing voices. Yet amid this growing political repression, Bangladesh in many respects is thriving. Under Hasina, Bangladesh has seen rapid economic growth, averaging close to 6.5% since 2009. That growth comes amid two decades of impressive socioeconomic development, driven by the phenomenal output of its apparel sector. If you're wearing a t-shirt right now, there's a good chance it was manufactured in Bangladesh. In its five-decade history, Bangladesh has defied expectations. It came into existence as one of the world's poorest countries, ravaged by natural disasters and a calamitous civil war. Henry Kissinger famously called it a basket case. Today, Bangladesh is a basket of contradictions and a paradox for many development economists because of its socioeconomic progress that's come in spite of poor governance and rampant corruption. Like her country, Hasina too has defied expectations. She's the daughter of the country's founder, Sheikh Mujibur Rahman, who led the country in its secession from Pakistan in 1971. Then in 1975, Mujib was killed along with his wife and many of his children by mutinous army officers. Hasina and her sister Rehana, both based in West Germany at the time, were Mujib's sole surviving immediate relatives. For the next 16 years after Mujib's assassination, Bangladesh was under military rule. One of those military officers was General Zia Rahman, the husband of the current opposition leader, Khaleda Zia, who took the country on a rightward tilt. But General Zia, too, was assassinated in 1981. His successor, General Ershad, ruled until 1991. Since then, Bangladesh has seen continuous civilian rule, except for a brief interval in the mid-2000s. The country's politics has been dominated by the two ladies, Sheikh Hasina and Khaleda Zia, inheritors of bloody political mantles due to assassination. And under Hasina, Bangladesh is becoming a one-party state, yet there are some indications Hasina's power has peaked. Since October 28th, Bangladesh has been rocked by violent protests as public discontent rises due to high inflation. So while an election victory is all but certain for Hasina, there are indications her political winning streak may soon come to an end. To discuss where Bangladesh is headed, I spoke with Dr. Ali Riaz, a distinguished professor of political science at Illinois State University and an expert on Bangladeshi politics. I spoke with Dr. Riaz last week, days before the elections took place. Dr. Riaz, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So Bangladesh is a mono-ethnic, mainly Muslim society. To the outside observer, it may be difficult to understand what are the drivers of political division in the country. So help us understand what underlies the political polarization that we're seeing in Bangladesh today. What are the broader factors at play? Is it religion and the question of secularism? Or are we seeing competing cults of personality and patronage networks? What is this battle all about?
this battle is about the soul of the country, so to speak, in the sense that Bangladesh was established in 1971 with a commitment to have equality, social justice, and human dignity. But that is what has slipped out over the years that we have seen. So I would say this is the battle of the soul, how to return to the founding principles of Bangladesh. Now, this is where the divide comes, in some ways contrived. Let us take the one that you were talking about, the religion secularism question. Bangladesh, as you have mentioned, it's a mono-religious to a certain extent. Yes, there are diversities. Of course, 88 or 89% are Muslim. But there are Hindus and Christians and others there. The way it should have been designed, it should have incorporated, include an inclusive society that would transcend this kind of thing that the religious has put us in a different camp. But it has been politicized. It has been used for the personal gain and political, immediate political gains. And we have seen the changes in the constitution of bringing the religion into the mix. And then it was taken out in all instances. Nobody actually consulted the people. There hasn't been any referendum or anything. So the religion question is there, but the religion question has been politicized, and that's what actually creates this religion and so-called secularism kind of divide. Because these are not contradictory. Being a Bangladeshi and Muslims and practicing those which are not clearly defined by the religion has been for centuries. You know. Then why it is now so much at the forefront? Because it has been in some ways being used as a tool to create a division for the political. In similar fashion, when you are talking with personal power, yes, personification of politics has taken place. We have seen how Bangladesh Awami League, led by Sheikh Hasina, is practically around the figure called Sheikh Mujibur Rahman, the founder president of Bangladesh. But and similarly, in case of the Bangladesh Nationalist Party, BNP, it has been Jiaur Rahman, who has ruled the country for a few years. But this is the political culture, you know. So on the one hand, is it good? No, it is not good. And this is because of the lack of democracy. If Bangladesh has continued practicing the democracy, then it would have been able to transcend that on this personal cult-like, you know, political parties. But it hasn't happened. Bangladesh has seen, as I say, from until 1990s, civilian and military authoritarianism. In 75, Bangladesh had one party system. And this brutal, you know, killing of Sheikh Mujibur Rahman's family and his associates. And then we have seen the assassination of Zia Rahman and so on and so forth. So all this tumultuous period until 1990 was civilian and military authoritarianism. We moved into the Democracy Party in 1991. But within 15 years, in the absence of democratic institutions, it fell apart. So all the divide is in large measure that we see are contrived, actually, to my understanding. Will there be differences? Of course there will be differences. Democratic politics requires difference. But since there was no democracy, so to speak, in the true sense of the term, the absence of democratic practices and institutions have led to this kind of situation. So that is how I see the situation.
And so when we look at the prevalence of hereditary politics in Bangladesh, is there, and you may have hinted at this, is there a broader cultural disposition that creates, you know, an environment for this? Or, you know, do, you know, for example, the role of political assassinations play a role in this? For example, you know, Sheikh Mujib was assassinated. General Zia Rahman was also assassinated. And so their heirs, their political heirs, you know, may have this desire to continue the legacy of those who were, you know, removed from this world in unjust terms. So I'm wondering what it drives the resilience of hereditary politics in Bangladesh. Is it similar to what we see elsewhere in South Asia, in Pakistan and India?
It is similar to Pakistan and India and Sri Lanka as well, if we look at the Sri Lankan politics. So there is a South Asian cultural issue that you can see. Also, in case of Bangladesh, and going back to the democracy question, the democracy is not only the governance, it is the culture, it is the ethos, it is the practice, you know, through all kinds of social political institutions. That constrained this. And then, of course, the assassination and heir apparent of all these had to come and rescue the political. Sheikh Hasina took the leadership of Awami League in 1980 when she came back after 5 years of exile, when her party was practically falling apart. So she became the symbol that would bring this to get party together. And what is the symbol? Why she is a symbol? Because she is the heir of Sheikh Mujibur. In similar fashion that in case of Khalida Diya, she entered into politics after the assassination of Zia-ul-Rahman, and even a few years after that, actually. Zia-ul-Rahman was assassinated in 1980, and she expected that this party would continue, but then they faced this military intervention, they were deposed from power, and then this pro-democracy movement emerged. Khalida Diya had to take it, the reign, so to speak, and move forward. So one thing is this political culture. Socially, this culture is there in Bangladesh, this hierarchy, this kind of, and I would call legacy of feudalism, that this is how the society is structured. Then we have this lack of democracy. And the third element is this, what has happened since then is that it permeated through the whole organization. It is not only on the top, you know. If you go to the very local level, especially over the last 15 years, what we see that political parties, particularly in case of Awami League, which had power, that even in the local district, even in the sub-district level, that is, the husband is the leader of the Awami League, the wife is the leader of the Women's Awami League, son is the youth league. Why? Because that accountability mechanism has not been created. There has not been an effort to have this grassroots involved in the political. And that is why in case of the nominations of parliamentary seats, you would see that people who are not involved in the party suddenly comes into the party, gets this nomination, gets elected. I call this absentee lordism in case of Bangladeshi politics. All these things actually contributed to this. But again, the solution could have been if there was an accountable mechanism, intra-party democracy, you know, then you would have seen that this is not absent. And Arif, a very interesting thing in case of Bangladesh, you know what? Only party that actually practiced intra-party democracy is Jamaat-e-Islami Bangladesh, you know, an Islamist party, the largest established party. The other political parties, whether you look at the left or the centrist or left, right of center, whether it be BNP, Awami League, and all the left political parties. Lately, CPP, that is Communist Party of Bangladesh, is trying to get out of it. But there has been this kind of long-standing policies and long-standing practice. So all of these together created a political culture within which this continues.
That's a great point, because if you look at Pakistan, for example, Jamaat-e-Islami, there's a branch of Jamaat-e-Islami there as well. And in terms of Pakistani political parties, it's one of the few that really has a kind of robust and somewhat egalitarian intra-party election system, whereas the other parties are essentially cults of personality. They may be coherent ideologies that drive their political existence, or at least their initial formation, but they've devolved into these blocks of personalities. And so you see these splinter groups that are essentially based off of one key leader. And so,
and that is, sorry for interrupting you, that is what happens is that even at the local level, you know, the party seems to become something that is around an individual. It is not a party based on the ideological affinity or something of that kind. So this patron-client relationship, who can actually provide me, draws people into the political, protecting them. And more undemocratic politics is practiced, whether it is during Ershad, General Ershad's regime, or partly Zia-ul-Rahman's regime, or even under other political parties like BNP and Awami. The leader who can provide me some kind of impunity, protect me from the all kinds of legal, you know, repercussion, I tend to be with him or her. That is what happens here.
Yeah, and so there is an entire discussion we can have over the political economy of politics and the sort of superficial democratic process in Bangladesh and many other countries in the region. But when it comes to these elections that are taking place, the opposition BNP is boycotting the polls, and they're demanding a return to the caretaker setup that existed in the 1990s that was tasked with overseeing the election process in a supposedly impartial manner. And that did succeed to some degree in the 90s, but it was ended in 2011 under the Hasina government. Now, public opinion polls in Bangladesh show that reverting back to the caretaker setup was quite popular. But at the same time, and correct me if I'm wrong, the military did use the caretaker system from 2006 to 2008 to try to reshape Bangladeshi politics. It effectively ran the show then. So I'm wondering whether Sheikh Hasina's opposition to the caretaker system has some justification. And in terms of these kind of baby steps to improving the democratic process, is there an alternative way to ensure that credible and competitive elections can take place, maybe like through an empowered election commission?
Let us start with two facts. Number one is that over the years since independence, there have been 11 elections, right? The 12th is being now expected to be held on 7th of January. Over this period, out of those 11 elections, only four actually was considered relatively free and fair. All of them were held under interim cabinet government, which means the remaining seven elections, whether it was held under Sheikh Mujibur Rahman in 73, under Zia-ur Rahman in 79, under General Ershad in 86, 88, or Khalid Zia in 1996, February, none were fair. Why? Because the administrative structure as such is that if someone is in power, civil administration and the law enforcement agencies tend to side with them and manipulate the election. That is the fact. Number two fact is that Awami League always refers to the verdict of the court, which told that, yes, the caretaker government is inconsistent with the democratic practice and should be void prospective. This is the part, prospective, not immediate. And its opinion in the short order that actually came is that it should be holding next to election under caretaker government. Otherwise, there would be chaotic situation. That was written in the initial verdict that came. It's a short four-sentence verdict, but that is what came, which was completely disregarded. So the argument is that, you know, the court told us to do that way. No, that's not true. Now, let us move on to the third element, that a committee was set, you know, appointed within the parliament, and that committee to look into the constitutional provisions of caretaker. That committee, initially it was a 15-member committee, BNP didn't participate. It ended up with all the members from the ruling Awami League. It had consulted more than 100 people, including former Chief Justice. Tell me any startup like they met. What was their conclusion after 20-plus meetings? Their conclusion was that caretaker government should be remained. You know, it should be continued with the caveat. What is the caveat? There should be a clear timeline, i.e. 90 days, and there should be a clear stipulation that this government cannot do anything beyond normal routine duties. That changed in one single meeting when the committee met Prime Minister Sheikh Hasina. So it was singularly decided that it has to be reversed, right? It has to be repealed. So yes, the points that you are making that it has been abused to a certain extent between 2006, 2007 and 8, to be precise, January 11, 2007, until the election took place in 2008. But it could be corrected. You know, throwing maybe out of the bathwater is not the solution, because other institutions have not been prepared to take on this task. You're talking with the Election Commission. The Election Commission's budget is controlled by the executive branch of Bangladesh government. So how would you expect? The process that they appoint the Election Commission commissioners, it's standard, it's the flawed. because it says that the president would appoint them, right? But Bangladesh Constitution also says that president can only do two things without the consultation of the prime minister. One is the appointing the prime minister, and the second is appointing the chief justice. That means when the president is appointing the electoral commissioners, is he consulting the prime minister or not? If he's not consulting, then he's violating the constitution. If he's consulting a political party leader who is going to be in the election under this election commission. Am I going to appoint someone who is going to be not fair to me, quote unquote, you know, the fairness? This is why the election commission, empowering election commission, is not a solution until actually you make that correction. Until then, the, you know, caretaker government was the only provision that would have delivered. History tells us that would have delivered a fair election. That's why I think the argument that is made by the government, especially the ruling party, and the way it was repeated, you know, beyond this committee, has that been consulted with the Bangladeshi people? Could there have been a referendum on this? Should we have asked Bangladeshis whether they like it? They just went through this experience of 2007 and 8, right? They might have actually approved this. We don't know, but nobody asked.
Yeah, yeah. And at least in terms of, there was a poll conducted by the IRI in April, and a majority supported the return of this caretaker setup.
Even after all these years, if you look at the election before the election of 2014, there was a series of surveys conducted by the Daily Star, by Toto Malu, and a bunch of other organizations. In all cases, in 2013 and 2014, overwhelming majority was supportive of caretaker.
This monopolization of power by Hasina strikes me as odd, given the fact that Bangladesh and Bengali society at a broader historical level is really marked by, in my view, a strong civil society. So it seems like there is a discrepancy between a very boisterous, robust political culture, and then this very controlled political system. It seems very odd to me as an outside observer.
Arif, in this case, if I may, you know, what has happened since 2014, particularly, if not before, definitely after 2014, the robust civil society that you are speaking of in case of Bangladesh, which played a pivotal role in pro-democracy movement between 1982 and 1992, has been practically decimated, you know, because of two reasons. Number one, the politicization, which it is not only Awami League which did it, it is BNP which did it. Post-1991, we have seen the civil society being so partisan that they have become divided into two camps. But then again, we have seen how the vilification, an orchestrated vilification from the ruling party since 2014, that against the civil society. Then we saw the 2016 law that was passed by the parliament, which controlled and created bottlenecks, you know, hindrances in getting funding for the civil society. So the civil society that we see in Bangladesh today is the ghost of its past, actually. It is no longer that case, because this is what happens with any authoritarian regime. More and more, this regime has moved towards authoritarianism. It has curtailed the freedom of press. It has curtailed the freedom of media. It has curtailed the freedom of assembly. It has decimated civil society. And it has shaped the political discourse in many ways, which would embolden their position, their argument, and keep them as completely as if they're unparalleled and there is no alternative to them.
Yeah. And that's a shame because, you know, when we look at before Bangladesh was formed, when it was East Pakistan, during the 1950s and 60s, what we saw in that period was that there was a very robust civil society, and that was one element which there was a real push for language rights and a deepening of the democratic political process. And in terms of opposing authoritarianism in what was then a united Pakistan, there was quite a formidable opposition in what was then East Pakistan. And now for that to be sort of extinguished through a more, you know, local authoritarianism is unfortunate given the tremendous sacrifices that you know, what were then Bengalis and now Bangladeshi nationals have made over the decades in terms of producing a political system that at least, you know, is supposed to work for them. Now, when we look at the post-election scenario, there are these ongoing protests and some violence in the country. Do you see it as escalating? Because when I look at what the options are available for the BNP, it doesn't seem like they have any option but to pursue a path of escalation. And so do you think that's the case? Do you think in the coming weeks and months, things might be getting worse? And could we see a repeat of, let's say, 1996, when the elections were held again on terms that were agreeable to all parties? Or could we see a repeat of 2006 when the army effectively intervened?
Both these two point of time that you're referring to, the situation now in 2024 is different in many ways. Number one, the intervention of military is very much unlikely because the purging and the reshaping of the military that has taken place, particularly since 2009. If you recall the situation with the mutiny in then the paramilitary force called BDR, now it is named different. Since then, there has been quite a serious purge and completely cleaning up the military rank and file, and to a great extent, it had been politicized. So I don't see or anticipate any military intervention like 2007. Then you were talking about the 1996. It depends on how much the opposition, particularly BNP, can mount movement, mass mobilization. That too is very difficult because of the enormous strength and capacity, coercive capacity of the state, surveillance capacity of the state. The, you know, the culture of fear has permeated the society. Even if you go to Dhaka or beyond Dhaka, what you see, people are so afraid to talk. I mean, this has been achieved in a very deliberate manner. Let us take the example of a law called Digital Security Act, which was came into being in 2018, October. That has practically, you know, not only diminished, practically it created a situation. The cyberspace is very much controlled. If you say something, do something, even if you know, just indicate you have liked, you know, someone's statement contrary to the government narrative, you are open to persecution. And according to government statistics, between October 2018 and January 2023, 7,001 cases were filed. And I've done a study and I continue to monitor the Digital Security Act. According to our estimate, each case has at least three persons who has been alleged to have committed a crime. That means 21,000 people have been charged, even if the government official statistics are correct. So the point is that what is the way out? I think, and this is what I've been speaking for the last year or so. This election is the most important election the Bangladesh ever had. The way I put it, this could turn out with the most consequential election of Bangladesh's 52 years history. The irony lies that there is no opposition, but yet why it might become the most consequential because this would actually determine what is the future political landscape. What I see, and I'm afraid that it may turn out to be a Cambodia scenario, that only political parties which align with the government narrative, which align with the government ideology, would be able to survive. The rest of them would actually be pushed to the margin. That is the existential question for BNP and the opposition, which the parties which have decided to boycott this election. In some measures, the line has been drawn on the sand, So what is the option left? Street agitation, mobilization, that is only. The other thing, which is, I think, is very important, how the international community react to it. Because for the United States, for the Western countries, which have been insisting on a free, fair election, this is not a free, fair election. This is not an election at all, as we see what is happening on 7th of January, because it is a competition, a contrived, an engineered competition between the Awami League official candidate versus the so-called independents. They have put 21 plus thousand people into jail. They have convicted 1,500 plus people over a period of 4 to 6 weeks. All the leadership of the BNP is in check. This is not an election. So after the election, there are two ways that it can go. You know, one is more agitation, and that would be a serious escalation and possibly violent situation. The other could be the state would repress in such a manner that might include, unfortunately, banning of the major political parties, including the BNP, you know, which has happened in case of Cambodia. In some ways, it had happened in Benin, you know, kind of situation we might see. Though the minister recently told the newspaper that now we're not planning to ban, but they have not banned Jamaat Islami either. You know, but Jamaat Islami has been pushed into underground through this judicial and extrajudicial manner. So I'm very much concerned, I'm very much worried about the next post-January 7 political landscape and where Bangladesh might lead it.
Yeah, and what you describe here is really a global phenomenon where we see the ascendance of a techno-repressive state that uses digital surveillance in order to control people, because everyone now has a camera and a microphone in their pocket, and so they can show themselves to the world, or unwittingly, they can be observed by the powers that be. And Bangladesh is among the countries that have purchased surveillance software from Israel and other countries in order to monitor dissidents in their own country. And so, you know, in the late 2000s into the early 2010s, we saw, you know, the high period of digital democracy and civil society and dissidents using Twitter and other social media networks to voice themselves and organize. And that was most, you know, manifested in Egypt, where we saw, you know, the protests in Tahrir Square that brought down Hosni Mubarak. And then came Assisi and that fierce repressive regime. And I think, unfortunately, as you your comments indicate, that path of repression or further repression looks to be in Bangladesh's future, and hopefully it can be avoided. But it really requires, I think, the kind of a perfect, you know, coordination between the international community and then smart action by local political activists. Now, when we look at the coverage of Bangladesh in the international press, when we see, you know, headlines from publications like The Economist, for the past 5 years or so, or maybe a bit sooner, the headlines have been pretty positive. And so there's a general tendency to focus on these top-line economic indicators that suggest a really rosy picture. So, for example, according to official data, Bangladesh has averaged around 6.5% annual economic growth during the era of Sheikh Hasina since 2009. And then in terms of human development, at least in terms of official data, we've seen some real gains in terms of life expectancy, primary school enrollment rates, and per capita income, which are all now higher than both India and Pakistan, at least according to official data. So first, I'd like to ask you, how accurate are these figures?
Autocrats tend to manufacture data. They like statistics. They're very much, and this is not only about Bangladesh, or for that matter, you can look at any other place. Autocratic regimes tend to manufacture data that would give you a better picture. Having said that, first of all, the data that is provided by the Bangladesh government, which created this narrative that, oh, Bangladesh is making enormous economic progress, is beyond this, you know, manufacturing part of it. What should we look into it? I mean, from 2018-19 fiscal year, the leading economist in Bangladesh and the organization such as CPD, that is Center for Policy Dialogue, or SANE, which is the South Asian Networks of Economic Modeling, they have been arguing that, look, you know, the number doesn't match. There are three sectors, right, with respect to industry and agriculture and service. If you look at separately and then add them up, that doesn't go to 7%, 8% the government is claiming. And as a matter of fact, in one instance, government claimed that this is the growth that we have achieved. And a year later, they said, oh, no, there was a mistake. Actually, it is far less than what we told you. But by then, all the media around the world has already spoken, right? There's 7% growth, 7% growth, you know, kind of. So that is number one that you have to take into account. The second point that I would argue is this, you know, growth, whatever the achievement, I'm not suggesting that it hasn't been growing. The GDP growth has been significant, sufficient to move forward. But is it entirely a state's achievement? In case of Bangladesh, and particularly when you were talking about this, social development, this is a combination of three forces. It is the state, private entrepreneurs, and non-governmental organization, NGO. You know, especially if you look at the social indicators, like, you know, women's empowerment, bringing female children into school, school enrollment going up, health sector, you know, life expectancy increased. Is it the state alone did it? State was one of the three actors, I say. You know, in case of the economy's growth, it is the private entrepreneurship, private sectors, which have contributed to it immensely. And those who have contributed most, who are the people that have contributed? It is the ready-made garment sector in case of Bangladesh. When you were looking at the number, who are these people? I mean, the female, mostly underaged female, who have been going through enormous hardship, yet they have contributed. Who are the one making the second contribution to Bangladesh economy? It is the short-term expatriate migrant workers. How the state have treated them? Very badly. Look at what is happening right now with respect to ready-made garment sector. You know, how the workers have been treated. Look at how the migrants have been treated over the years. So claiming something is good, that is what the government does. Now, even they claim that if the students are doing good, that is their achievement. I don't get it. But the point is that it is this kind of narrative actually conceals a lot of. One is this broader picture, right on. And then if you look at what is this achievement at me, the disparity has increased enormously. I mean, the indicators like Gini coefficient, if you look at them, Bangladesh has now raised it to, according to the official statistic, which came out 2 weeks ago, you know, or more than less than 2 weeks, that Bangladesh's Gini coefficient is 0.499, which is basically when there is 0.5, we call it highly disparity in society. And it has increased. In 2010, it was 0.458. Which means over the years, if the last 13 years, the government is claiming that they have made enormous economic growth, where did it go? We know where did it go, you know? We know where did it go, because 21%, loan default in case of banks is pretty much 10, 11%. Where did this money go? Billions of dollars have been siphoned off without the knowledge of the government, without the political, coverage, in some ways, patronage of the government is not possible. The energy sector, we have seen enormous subsidy being provided to a handful of people who have then, in many instances, have just taken that money and took it out. Yeah. So, yes, this growth are there, but you have to look at the story beneath this, that what is happening, how it is. I'm not talking about the political burden. Plain and simple thing of looking into the energy sector, how it has been used for siphoning off money from the public. And when we are talking about public, we are talking about the people who have done enormous hardship, who have gone through enormous hardship to create this wealth, and then these wealths are being plundered by this regime. So should we not talk about that,
Yeah, and many observers point to what they call the Bangladesh paradox, that there's this combination of poor governance and high levels of corruption with strong socioeconomic development. And you essentially outline that, the how that has been structured in terms of this, you know, the state not necessarily being responsible for many of the gains in terms of the women's societal gains and all that.
Arif, I define Bangladesh paradox differently, you know. I define Bangladesh paradox, the way people should talk about it is that, there is malgovernance yet economic development. I put it different. I say the paradox lies here, on two levels. Number one, the paradox lies, if Bangladesh has made so much achievement in economic growth, why so many people are actually poor and the poverty increasing, you know, the disparity increasing. Today we are talking about, today as we speak, you know, 21% of Bangladeshis have food insecurity. If Bangladesh has made so much growth and so many things, where does it? This is the paradox. The paradox lies here. Those who actually created this wealth are at the bottom end, and even asking for $10 by the RMG sectors seems to be a big thing for this country. Whereas there have been incidents after incidents where they died and there was no justice to them, nothing, absolutely. This is the paradox.
Yeah. And, you know, in terms of that growth, you know, you talked about the ready-made garment sector, and that's a big driver, the major driver, or perhaps the only driver of Bangladesh's export industry. And it's driven, has been driven over the decades by some smart policymaking decisions at the macroeconomic level, but also subsidized natural gas, which Bangladesh was once abundant in, and then some of the world's lowest wages. And from time to time, textile workers organize and protest, and they're repressed by not just the Rapid Action Battalion that has been sanctioned by the United States and is implicated in over 600 extrajudicial killings, but also by a specialized industrial police force for these export processing zones. And so if many of our listeners are, you know, wearing a t-shirt or something, it's very much likely that that t-shirt is from Bangladesh. And there is this kind of system of exploitation and repression that undergirds that simple garment that reaches so many different markets, particularly in the West. Now, I'm wondering, when we look at, we can contest the accuracy of the growth figures and the broader socioeconomic indicators that are coming out of Bangladesh at an official level. But let's assume there has been some kind of positive trajectory. To what extent is this really sustainable? Because it's dependent on one sector. It's really sensitive to low wages, and there's growing pressure to increase those wages. And there was an agreement, I think, in November to do that. And now we see a trend towards nearshoring in the garment industry in the wake of the COVID pandemic. And I'm wondering, for Bangladesh to grow at the next level, this has sort of the primary initial level of the East Asian model of growth, where essentially, you know, borderline slave labor works in the garment industry, and then they move on to greater, you know, productivity and value-added manufacturing, and then hopefully something on the more technical side. I'm wondering, for that next stage of growth in Bangladesh, to what extent is political reform and democratization and stability really prerequisites of that? Can Bangladesh grow, sustain growth in this kind of one-party or one-party dominant system model?
I don't think so. For several reasons. Number one, the one that you have alluded to or has spoken of is the over-dependence on two sectors. Basically, Bangladesh economy is standing, if you take, you know, three pillars of Bangladesh economy. One is the agricultural productivity, despite the government's reluctance to, you know, subsidize fertilizer. And others, the farmers have been doing a great job. And two others are the migrant workers, remittance and the RMG sector. Now, in terms of the industry, it is basically the RMG sector. Without diversification, there is not possibility that it can sustain this for a long period. In the examples that you cited in case of East Asia, they actually moved for. They didn't stay there. And that is what actually brought all this to Bangladesh, right? Because the East Asian countries and the Southeast Asian countries moved past that point. They couldn't afford to have this kind of, you know, high labor intensive and low skilled and low paid jobs. Is it happening in case of Bangladesh? No, it is not happening. So that is first thing, the diversification. And that can happen only if this system of cronyism that they have established is broken. Now the government sector's people are so close to the regime. They get benefit out of it, and they would like to continue that. Government, in exchange of their support, they would love to have this kind of quote-unquote stability. whenever someone speaks of stability and peace and other things, I say, I'm not going to actually visit a graveyard because that is the best place to have the stability and peace, but I don't want to go. So the diversification is one thing. The second thing is the political business nexus, unholy nexus. There should be a cooperative relation, but what I see is an unholy nexus. That is what creates a situation where the bank default can actually reach to 10-11, where we have seen that billions of dollars, $9 billion, according to one account, has been siphoned off. You know, how that happens. So the corruption, the cronyism, how do you actually confront those things when you have a mandate from it, when you are accountable to the citizens? Every 5 years or so, you have to go. And then also, it is not only the vertical accountant. There has to be horizontal. You have strong civil society. You have strong institutions like Anti-Corruption Commission, which actually can hold you accountable without any kind of political interest. When you have a judiciary which is so independent that it can stand up to the prime minister, or for that matter, anybody, and say that you're wrong and you can be held accountable here. So without that kind of arrangement on the political economy part, that there has to be this reform. And then institutional reforms. The banking sector has been in this kind of situation for a decade. Yet every time International Monetary Fund goes and say these are to be done, government will say, yes, here. We're going to do it. And then they conveniently forget, or actually in a selective amnesia was here, that they simply don't talk. Without these institutional reforms which are required, which cannot be done without an accountable political system, That's why it is this deeply connected that, without a democratic system, however flawed it is, at least accountability may. I keep on insisting on election, free and fair election. Over the last year and a half, I've been speaking. A lot of people told me that, why you are so obsessed with elections? Election doesn't make any. I say, no, election is the first step. This is the door to enter into this conversation of accountability, right? Election by itself is not democracy. Election alone does not deliver democracy or accountability unless you have the photo, but you cannot enter into the room without that. That's why you say the weather sustainable. I said not sustainable in the long term. Now the borrowing has reached to $200 billion. This part we haven't talked about. And if that what happened in Bangladesh, enormous, borrowing from various kind of multilateral, bilateral, sources. Now they have to spend billions of dollars for debt servicing. Where are they going to get those money, in the coming years? What we are witnessing, the dwindling, foreign reserves, is because of that. They have to pay enormous debt service. Where would they go from if you don't earn? And that is why the reform in the productive, sector, the industrial sector, agricultural reform, and institutional reforms are required to keep a sustainable growth of Bangladesh.
Yeah, so a more open political environment, you say, would empower these kind of corrective forces in Bangladesh from both the civil society as well as governmental institutions that would help put the country on a path of more equitable and sustainable growth in a time in which social inequality is rising both in Bangladesh as well as and many other parts of the world. Now, when we look at foreign policy, Sheikh Hasina has developed a bit more of an adversarial relationship with the United States in recent years. The U.S. has put pressure on Hasina, sanctioning the RAB in 2021, and then has also announced potential visa bans on officials who undermine the electoral process. At the same time, India is sticking with Hasina, and China and Russia have also used the U.S. pressure to criticize what they say is U.S. interference in Bangladesh. And Bangladesh has received financing from both China and India, and it's also going to be home to a nuclear power plant that will be constructed by Russia. So I'm wondering, in your view, does it seem like the U.S. pressure has been ineffective? And could it be said that Hasina has leveraged great power rivalry to her benefit?
Did she do it to our benefit? Yes, to that extent that actually she has benefited out of it. We'll stay in power. I mean, unless something dramatic happens before the next hours or so, in the sense that 7th January is pretty much at the door, post 7th January. She has leveraged it for her own continuation of power. But is it good for Bangladesh? I mean, look at the economy, for example. Bangladesh's trade relationship with the United States, the trade balance is in favor of Bangladesh. If you look at with China, it is enormous beneficial to China to have the Bangladesh market. Same with India. If you look at, we talked about RMG sector, right? And the largest single country market of RMG, ready-made garment, is the United States. You know, if we take, consider many countries together, then European Union, right? So the way it happens is that basically Bangladesh earns money from the West and spends it in the East. Can you continue that one with this if there is some kind of oppression? And if the markets contract because of various kinds of things in the West. So the global power rivalry that you are speaking has put Bangladesh into a tug of war kind of situation. It should have been Bangladesh's own interest that should have driven its choices. But like any authoritarian, especially personalistic authoritarian regime, Sheikh Hasina and her government has chosen a path that is actually beneficial to her and her government and the party, but not the long-term interest. This is somewhat a mystery why India actually allied with China when they are speaking about, you know, within the Asia-Pacific region, suspect Indo-Pacific strategy, they should have actually, India should have been with the United States. But they didn't. A, because India's global, you know, aspiration that it doesn't want to see a major power at their back here as they consider South Asia as their back here. So they have allied with China, which they did in case of Myanmar as well. So, you know, they think that they can be with China instead. U.S. presence would be detrimental to their long-term interests, both in terms of economy, because the business interest drives Indian policies quite significantly. Strategic interest and business interests both have aligned in against United States, though they're allies. So now what happens after the election? And that is the billion-dollar question, even not million, it's billions of dollar question in the sense that this rivalry would continue. This is not going to go away. With respect to U.S. policies that you have mentioned with respect to RAB sanction, which I don't think was directly connected to the election, the visa policy did. Visa policy law is not going to, was not supposed to actually shape the political landscape in any way or fashion. So here, the U.S. has a choice at this point. Whether they're in a bind or not, I don't know, but they have a choice. Number one is that they, what they can do, they can retreat. Now, they're okay, fine, whatever happened, we tried it, didn't work. But that would be basically delivering South Asia, the Chinese influence. Why? Because it is not only Bangladesh. There would be a domino effect in case of Maldives, which we have already seen, you know, India's policy failure. Then it would be Nepal, it would be Sri Lanka, or everywhere. So U.S. has a choice to make whether they would actually do what they have done in 2014 or 2018. That is basically, oh, business as usual, engagement limit. Or they can actually, you know, ramp up its action. They have not acted actually so far. The visa policy is not an action. It is just, you know, an indication of action. Now, post January 7, whether they are going to act, it is the unknown part of it. But they have a responsibility to, you know, the Europeans need to actually put their act together and act. Because otherwise, what we're going to witness is the increased influence of China. And why am I concerned about Chinese influence? You know, I'm concerned because China's policy is not only about money, but China's policy is about changing the global order. You know, China's package doesn't come money alone. There's a political ideology behind it. This one-party system, this authoritarian system, you know, development, you know, rapid development without any kind of regard for human rights or environment or anything of that. So that is what concerns me going forward, that yes, she might have, Xi Jinping might have maneuvered well to a certain extent, but the game is not over yet.
Yeah, and the game is not over yet. But Sheikh Hasina is 76 years old. So I'm wondering, where do you think the party will be headed, you know, if and, you know, once her time comes to an end? Her son, Sajib, seems to be based in the U.S., and she has a daughter. She may be grooming her to be a successor. What do you think the future is for the party and for Bangladesh after Hasina?
Arif, the very question that you have asked, and everyone asked that question, and I respond in a similar fashion, you know. The very question implies that Bangladesh is not a democracy. It is a personalistic authoritarianism. Did you ask that question, who would be the successor of Biden, whether his son? Did we ask about Rishi Sunak in case of Britain, or for that matter, Germany, or for that matter, Japan? We asked that question. We don't. That means we are acknowledging the fact that Bangladesh has moved away from democracy and there should be the path going forward. Now, coming to the question that you have raised, which is, you know, I'm not saying that it is not a valid question. It is a valid question, given the culture, given the situation that we are in. This is the stack of cards in front of us. So the point is that what would be the, you know, her successor? The succession plan seems to be absent in case of Sheikh Hasina, because in some ways, this is how I see it, she doesn't want to put forward a successor because that would create an understanding that there is an alternative to her. And this one should like to be seen as someone without the alternative, you know, because once you get into this alternative business, you never know where it would go. The second point with respect to her successor is that, you know, whether party would accept or not. In some ways, party would accept anybody that has any kind of lineage to Shikman. That leaves us with one person, her son, her daughter, because her son seems to be reluctant to go back to Bangladesh. But also, there is a possibility that her, you know, sister could actually take up, at least as part of the transition, until either of them, the son or daughter, is ready. But that is, you know, having this conversation by itself is quite detrimental to any aspiration. We're simply ignoring that there are people, you know, there are, you know, 180 million, more than 90 million people are eligible to vote. So we are just ignoring them, that they have no say in this.
Right, yeah. Now, I want to conclude on a potentially hopeful note. I'd like you to outline a scenario in, let's say, 10 years from now, Bangladesh returns to something akin to a competitive democracy, not necessarily perfect, but with credible elections and meaningful restraint on executive power. And it's also able to sustain stability and healthy economic growth. You've touched on this a bit before, but what are three things that need to happen for that scenario to emerge?
Number one, there has to be a free, fair, inclusive election where all political parties can participate, and in post-election situation, those who are vanquished would accept the result and the victor would ensure that the rights and, you know, privileges and all sorts of things are going to be accorded to the opposition as their due. That is number one. So electoral process is the key. Number two is the institutional reforms, that is the political institutions which actually can hold the executive accountable, such as, you know, independence of judiciary. Would it be 100%? No. At least some, you know, relative independence of judiciary. And institutions such as anti-corruption commissions, and institutions such as election commission, and also reforming, you know, or the Bangladesh Civil Service, how they are appointed, the process. So these are the political institutions, and that needs to be reformed. Number three is the economic institutions to be reformed, the banking sector to begin with. I mean, which is long, long, long overdue, that banking sector needs to be, you know, but also other financial institutions and those which are active in the economic arena needs to be, which would lead Bangladesh into thinking of diversification of its, you know, industrial sector, looking for newer market, having better understanding of the global economy and where it can actually go in the next step, instead of being beholden to a group of small group of people, then also just stuck with this, you know, low skill, low cost, you know, low paid job cycle that they are in.
And that was Dr. Ali Riaz of Illinois State University. Please subscribe to our show on your platform of choice. And thank you for tuning in.